Crouch. Bind. Set.
Joe presents the House of Rugby, together with Guinness.
I've got a good one for you this week.
Oh.
There's a man in a place with a bittersweet face, and he goes by the name of Ebenezer Good. His mates call him Ezer because he is a fine geezer, and he'll vibe up the place like no other man could. Which, a little-known fact, was a song written about you.
Well,
in 1992.
It was a song about me, but it was one that, that's how I got my nickname for Wasps.
Is it really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I actually didn't know that.
Genuinely.
Isn't it beautiful when things like that come together?
That's beautiful TV,
isn't
it?
That a lovely
TV? But that's also before Haskell was even... He was still, living the dream at Wellington.
Yeah.
Mike Friday, it is very, very nice to have you on. How long have you known Mike?
I've known Mike since probably 18,
that's
actually.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, maybe 18. Slightly before, 17, 18 maybe, yeah.
Little twinkle in the eye when you recalled the early days.
Yeah, a few stories. Yeah, well, we'll come on to that. Yeah. You're looking very edgy. Right. Like, you should have worn that gear when we had Ekenfenwar on, because, you know, like, with gear, you know...
This
like,
is a very nice little garb that's been sent through by a very good rugby charity.
Okay.
Which...
Am I getting the endorsement, or are we charity stuff?
No, we're doing some charity work.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a dirty word around my gaff, charity work.
Is it?
No, I do it, but obviously...
But I'm very, very glad
we're putting it out there. So what's the talk? Do you want to plug it? Do you want to talk about
that? I do, but I'm actually just going to get the exact details while you interview Mike very quickly.
It?
Yeah, I should have done that.
So, Mike, it's cool. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm very well. No, I'm good.
You're a bit of a fan of House Robbie, aren't you?
I do. I love it.
Ellis was good last week.
He was brilliant. I mean, I like authentic people that are down-to-earth, gritty, say how it is. And speak from the heart. And he is who he is. You know, I've only ever watched him from afar on the pitch and always thought he was a bit of a thug.
Yeah.
And he's handy on the pitch and he probably could be quite handy off the pitch.
Yeah. But he's a bit of a cuddler. He's lovely as well. It's that demeanour. You know, he's got one of them, like, serial killer demeanours.
Yeah.
But actually, he's, like, really lovely when you chip past
him. He's an authentic bloke. He's a real, real man and he says what he thinks. And, you know where you stand with those types of guys. So for me as a... If he was in the change room at Wasp in my day, he'd have been perfect in change room 10.
And who was likewise, in change room 10 with you?
Volley.
Right, yeah. Wow. You know, I once said to Paul Volley once, the biggest regret I've ever had, he was getting into me, right, going, oh, Haskell, you this, and I turned around and went, think I was being clever. I was like, fuck off, Oles, you can watch me in your retirement, right? And everyone just went quiet, and I honestly went... Yeah, I'm sorry, Mr. Paul, I'm so sorry. He's like, you fuck. And I, the car park afterwards, I was like, Paul, Mr. Volley, Mr. Paul, Mr. Sir, I'm really sorry. I really regret that because he was obviously a Wasp hero. And I just thought I was being too clever. And
He's also, as well, he's a little bit like Genge in the fact that more often than not, when we were Wasp Colts, we were on a Sunday morning, we'd have to go and bail him out of jail to get him ready to play in the Colts game in this afternoon. I mean, he was a proper handful. And again, like, people like Voles. You know, even Lawrence Scrace was in that changing room.
Really?
Some real
Buster
kind of,
White?
Buster, we didn't let him in that changing room. We'd have to lock that out. You know, he'd go with some of the other boys.
Was that Dean Ryan as well around that? Was that
Dean Ryan was slightly before.
Fine, okay. You've had a hell of a paper round, so
yeah,
it's difficult
exactly.
To work out
I mean,
age.
I think Dean Ryan gave me that paper round. I mean, he gave me a kicking when we were youngsters and we used to play 1v2s on a Thursday night. Used to just watch the likes of Buster White, you know, Dean Ryan, Mark Rigby, just
absolutely
kicking the shit out of one another. And the only person they didn't deal with was Francis Emerua. So Francis Emerua was the hardest man I've ever come across in rugby. You know, he should
because,
have been the first...
What set him apart?
He should have been the first black fella to play for England.
Yeah.
But he got gangrene in his leg from a broken leg. But he still found his way back to play in the Wasps first team. He was a softly spoken school teacher. But if you made him angry, like... His eyes would just come, he'd look right through you and you would be scared. So whenever they played Bath back in the late 90s, they just picked him to play against John Hall because John Hall had upset him on one occasion and you didn't upset Francis Emerua. I mean, he saved Lawrence's life on a tour, it's a Jean Deleuze trip when the back row were trying to dangle him out of the...
Oh, the window, by his, I remember because that was Lawrence talks about it as his initiation. They hung him out the window by his feet.
Is this Delalio?
Dean Ryan, Buster, Rigby. I mean, horrible men on the pitch.
You know, like when you meet people, you're like Mark is lovely, but you know when you've got people who meet like simmering anger.
Yeah.
So like you get into Riggers like with one bit of chat. So if I got into him, like I said, you're looking like very youthful today, kind of community centre gears, right? If I said that to him, he'd just be like, fucking, what do you mean, fucking? Yeah. It, straight off the bat, like simmering. So they were loose, but I asked Lawrence about his initiations and they said, they hung him out of a window.
Yeah.
By his ankles, actually out of the window by his ankles, upside down. And obviously he was
And that was a nice bit. because they also had the physio H-wave in there. And there was all sorts
of... Oh, really?
What is the physio H-wave?
Well, you know the old pulse machine? You know, Lawrence was a good-looking guy. So the reality is knees will, knees must. And then Francis rolled over from his bed and just went to him. Enough. And you've never seen three big, big blokes or, you know, just go... All right, Francis. I mean, that's how he rolled. Well, yeah.
The car battery on your ball was hanging over a window. Yeah. And just someone rolls over and goes, enough. I love that.
Sounds like a quiet Tuesday at school.
But they were so that was a bit before your time. So you Lawrence Gracie's selling insurance now, isn't it? So basically how the boys go around.
Oh, it is, and you know, it's a different time now, you know, where your whole life was rugby. Back then it was part of your life, so you had to have other skills and other strands, and you're always gonna have to go back to something. And that's how it was, and that changed room 10. They still have people like King are in there.
Right.
Denzel, Fraser, you know,
Denzel brushed his teeth then
Mark Denny.
Clifford then.
Clifford the Dragon.
Okay, because I thought it was, you know, the big orange dog, Clifford the dog,
no,
with the dog breath.
No.
So it was a Listerine dragon called Clifford.
If he's ever watches this, so heads a roll. But yeah.
Well, what's he going to do? Breathing this?
It was deadly, like the banter in there. You know, Shawsy would put his head around the room. Scrivener, you know, there's proper characters back in that kind of late 90s. What's changing room where a tight crew, but good times, yeah, good times.
I love that though. That's what I think. You know, when I when I finished at WAS or whatever, and I was looking around the change room, you talk about senior players, because I came up just on the tail end of all, you know, I still had Denny and Fraser and all those kind of massive characters. I looked round and you'd have these worldly wide guys and it all had a story and all had a thing and they all had adventures and everything else. Then you got to the end of it and I was in there and I was looking around going, I'm one of them blokes. I just felt very inadequate. I didn't feel like I had, you know, I looked around and the Lerber, you just didn't have those characters. I didn't think. And that's one of the big things of rugby,
Does it?
The issue about rugby a little bit at the moment is it's a little bit insular, isn't it? Yeah. You know, it's that's why Genge and his life and how he is and what he's had to deal with makes him such an authentic character in the game.
Yeah.
And long may that continue. We need more of those people to mix in and we need to experience more things in life than rugby, because rugby's only ever going to be part of your life. It's never going to be all your life, as we've talked about, you know?
Can I just check one thing, right? Have they flown you from America to get you here? Because they won't do me down the road.
The entire budget's gone for Geezer Airways.
I'm literally in and out. I landed back Sunday and then I fly off on Friday to New Zealand.
So you literally live in the dream, because I look at it now and I think, I saw you with the England, because we'll come on to how we met, had the England experience, you were doing bits and pieces. I remember you coming in and doing one-on-one scrum half work with people, and then I lost kind of track of bits and pieces. Then I saw you just living the dream in America. Obviously America with Perry Baker and the lads, just like finding these mental monsters who are just coming out of nowhere, smoking everyone, living the absolute dream with Phyllis. The only person's missing is Terry Sands.
Well, he's in the background, you never know, he's never far away, Sandsy.
Putting
the band back together.
It was like a naughty threesome.
Phil Greening.
Phil Greening, Mike Friday and Terry Sands.
Yeah.
Well, a triumph. And they were like the Father, Son and the Holy Ghost.
Right.
That was my very
first experience.
And that was my first experience of sevens, having those three. And it was, mate, it was some of the best times I've ever had in rugby.
Which we're going to come on to. Who gave you...
Ebenezer Good.
Yeah.
So obviously I was at WASP at the time.
I dread to think. Anybody Vera's?
So it was Riggers. So Mark Rigby again. And they just sat there and they're like, because I was the only bloke from South East London that came across. And he's Ebenezer Good. Yeah. No, you're a boy from South East London. You're our geezer. Because they were all North West London and
public school.
There's a mixed bag there, but there's a boys from Essex and all that, but north of the river. Not my bag. So the reality is that's how I ended up getting that name, and it literally stuck with me from that day on. I mean, I can't get rid of it.
I genuinely did not know that.
But isn't that good, though? That's what I love. That's what I miss more than anything else in ordinary life. You walk in, you've bought your best gears, you've had your lid done, you wear something or say something wrong once, and somebody gets something and it sticks
And you're
forever.
Still, 25 years on, being introduced as geezer to the world.
I mean, I've dusted about 15 people with permanent lifelong nicknames that you forget. I forget I've done it, and then you'll read a press thing and they go, why are you called that? They went, oh, James Haskell called it to me once. I've never got a nickname, apart from ones you can't say on camera.
Yes.
Exactly.
Welcome to House of Rugby. I think we're up and running. Nice to have you back with us. Brought to you by Joe Together, our very good friends at Guinness. James is here. We are wearing some nice threads. The charity is Looseheads.
Looseheads.
Is doing some very good stuff.
Do stuff on social media.
Mental health and linking it with rugby.
Yeah, mental health.
So thank you very much, Steve, for the garbs. And good luck with the good work that you're doing. And Mike is alongside as well. You've dipped in. You're about to dip out again. How are you feeling? Looking very well.
It's all right. Yeah, I mean, fortunately for me, I don't need the leg room, so it's right. All good, right? So
was a little go box bit,
oh, mate, yeah, yeah. I tell you, there's no chance of turning left with USA Rugby. So, you know, it's...
I would have thought they were cash money, don't they?
No, I mean, we're going through a restructuring at the moment. So you talk about spinning plates and things like that. Coaching the rugby on the pitch is the easy bit. And, you know, I've got great people like Phyllis around me that can do that, and Rocky now as well. So, but dealing with the off-pitch... All of that contractual stuff, dealing with the restructuring and the reorganisation and trying to create the pathways and the platform and the programme, for all intents and purposes, a country which is ridiculously big. You don't realise how big America is till you get there, on a budget that isn't even anywhere near what they put in the grassroots game here. That's the magnitude of...
Really?
The budget in the USA rugby as a whole across the entire country is probably 50% of what they put in the community game, I think. Wow. I think it's around 10, 11 million. You
can
know,
you
it's...
not use your black book to tap into a couple of global conglomerates
Exactly. I mean, where we're at is, you know, interestingly enough, everybody thinks America, cash-rich country, boom, money, no object. We operate on philanthropy. It's a huge part of American sport. Very different to the UK landscape. So, you know, I'm very, very fortunate in terms of we call them the Golden Eagles, which are the philanthropy group that support the men's sevens and now the women's sevens. And we're trying to grow that part of the programme until we can become commercially viable,
yeah,
which is the key and is the ultimate aim. Because once we do that, then all of a sudden we can put in the pathways, create the talent ID, look to complement the super sports in the high schools, let them go and chase the college dream, come back. And then we can really unlock the potential, not only in the sevens game, but then maybe, but a long time down the track in the 15s game.
So how is someone like Perry Baker or Carlin Isles or Danny Barrett, are they, you know, they are household names within the game of sevens and within rugby. Have they got opportunities that they're being looked after, or are they bouncing around a bit?
Yeah, I mean, the reality for them, Alex, is that if they rocked up in Fiji or they rock up in New Zealand or even here, they're better known than they are in their own country. And that's Perry and Carlin, who are probably two of the most well-known faces. Danny, the Boom Boom, is renowned for his physical efforts on occasion. But, you know, it's a very different landscape. You know, and it's, you know, again, without dramatising it, the reality is these boys live on the breadline currently. So, like, give you a perspective, right? And it's all about economies.
Yeah.
So, like, tier one economy, America, California's like living in Fulham. And these boys are getting by and could probably earn just as much stacking shelves in Walmart. That's the reality of where we are. So very much like professional rugby was here when it first started.
Yeah.
So we've got a huge job to reposition it. It's never going to be like American football and basketball, nor should it, because you can't create the commercial revenue. So similar to soccer here, right, or football. Yeah. But we've got a journey to go on, and it's a very similar journey, but it'll be different to what happened in the professional game over here, kind of 95 and onwards.
Yeah.
So it's early days, but you're trying to compete and stay with the top nations.
Yeah.
We're doing it on the sevens. We're mixing it with them. But we've got our own challenges.
But I just think out of nowhere, you've brought the kind of the American team, the sevens team up, and they become almost like a left field thing where they've like had a few good tournaments. People are like, oh, they're not consistent. Suddenly they're consistent and they've got these characters. And I think it's tailor-made to kick on.
Yeah.
And I think they're going to do some cool stuff with social media. You know, Carlin's always like racing people. Perry Baker, you know, does stuff. That, you know, all these kind of guys are doing a really interesting thing. I think it's hopefully it will kick on, because from the outside, out of all the sevens team, you want to watch American Fiji, you know.
They're box office, right?
Yeah.
And the reality, like you just talk about, they're characters. But, like, the diversity in the group, you know, you've got extremes like Perry and Carlin, and then you've got the other end, Maka and Effie, who won't say boo to a goose, but athletically he's ridiculous. He's a freak, like the other two in his own way. Mm. You know, that is the spectrum that we have in the USA team. And you're right, they are characters and they are authentic. I mean, Perry is Perry, right?
But also with the coaching staff as well. Like, with all due respect, you know, you've got a big character, a big personality. Phyllis is a unique man to himself. Rocky's, you know, he's probably the most normal one out of all, and he's a serial killer.
We put him in the cupboard every day.
he was a machine. I mean, do you remember? I know you. You coach.
Yeah.
You know, the fitness
this is Tony.
Level,
Rocky. Yeah.
Yeah, and the stuff he would do on the field and the training and his like his fitness and just his, you know, he probably wasn't in his own mind, the most skillful bloke in the world, but he just was
hands
a machine.
Like feet. I think that's how similar.
Hands like tits.
Everybody wanted him. First name on a team sheet. If you had a choice who they wanted in the team, back in that team when in 2003, 4, 5, yeah. 6, first person they wanted to hit was Rocky. Why? Because he does all the shit work, so they haven't got to do it.
Love that.
And he's a lovely guy as well, which helps. But I think it's like Taylor May with him. You probably, if you had Terry in there doing a few wheelie-dealy, you'd probably kick on to the next level.
Yeah.
What I love about this show is we've done half an hour and Si's like, King, say, please, will you get to the menu? One week, I'd like to do the entire show and then do the menu as the last thing we do and then say goodbye. Yeah, coming up on the show, thank you very much, and goodbye.
Yeah.
So we'll get to it. We're going to dig into your connection. We're going to have a quick look back at your career as well.
Wasps, I won't take
Quins,
long.
England sevens captain as well.
You were Quins, were you?
Let's not. We don't talk about that, Hask. That was nine months of my life.
I did not know that.
Touch on Olympics, and we've got an NFL-related perfect pull in honour of your links to America as well. I want to talk about Nate Ebner as well.
Oh yeah.
Interesting. You were having a giggle before we pressed record. Can we go back into the early days of the guru and the pup?
Yeah, well, I can't remember. Do you remember? Was it you? Because I remember when you came in, and I remember we did one session for the sevens, Middlesex sevens. Because I think the year before you got to the semis.
No, I got to the final. We played Bradford Bulls.
Yes, and they just turned out, and that was what kicked on to bringing Whitey in, wasn't it?
So Whitey was the angry man, like short man syndrome. Yeah. Perfect, we get on great. And he was an angry man. But you got a northerner and you got a Londoner, it's never going to end well.
And Craig was your fitness and...
He was Gats Ryan man, right? Yeah. So
Would you want to tell? Because what happened was that they got to the final, right? And they played Bradford.
Conscious of lots of names that people might not know.
So basically, Wasps got to the final and played against Bradford Bulls, right? And Bradford dismantled us, didn't they?
Yeah.
In that final, but like to a different extent. So Warren, from what I led to believe, went, these blokes are big, powerful, fit. That's what I want. And it took Whitey from them
I'm not sure whether Whitey came from there or he came from football. I wasn't sure if he came from Blackburn.
Well, I think he was up north anyway. He was northern, round
that'll, do, that'll do.
So he basically got them on board, and that's what sparked the whole Wasps. You know, that very next season was the sparking of the conditioning, bigger, fitter, Sean Edwards, mad blitz defence, beat everyone up, be fitter and bigger and stronger than everyone. Craig White was the mastermind.
He was, reverse periodisation. It was the first year that they brought it in.
What is that?
They didn't do any running for the first half of pre-season. So traditional pre-season was you run until you're sick and then you do weights alongside. Well, ain't happening. That wasn't happening under Whitey. These boys, by the time I turned up, I mean, they looked like they were
Hercules.
Yeah.
They were big old lumps. And I was like, oh, you boys looking good. So I'm thinking, oh, lovely jubbly, here we go. Literally couldn't run more than 10 yards between them. So by the end of the tournament, I think we got spanked in the first game. We won the second game in the plate, got spanked in the third game. And I've got people like Roy's are going, mate, why can't we do it? And I'm like, mate, because you ain't fit. But what I meant was you're not running fit.
Yeah.
But you had... Bobby was there.
Yeah.
Bobby...
Boucher.
Yeah, the water boy. He was obviously back then, he was Whitey's right-hand man. He was his eyes and his ears, right, because Whitey wasn't there. So I went back to work. So I was working at DTZ in the surveying. I get this call through my office phone. It's Whitey swearing, fuck you, what are you doing? Telling him, you don't know your... And I'm like, whoa! Who is this?
Could have been one of 100 people, though, couldn't it? Let's be honest.
And he says, it's Craig White, you know, what the fuck, you just undermine me. And I'm like, hold on a minute, whoa. And we talked it out for half an hour. I was like, well, can they run? No. Well, they're not fit. They are fit, they're just not running fit. I said, did you tell me this? He went, no. I said, well, bit of a miscommunication. And then typical Gats had just washed himself of it to start with. And then at the end of it, I met up with Gats later down the track, and he said, oh, we're not do that again, Mike. He said, look, I'll just let them get on with it. And, you know, Whitey has his way.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, Whitey is second to none in terms of doing what he does, and he still is. I know he's all into his yoga camps now. And
He masterminded Uruguay, I think, doesn't he? He's a performance.
Yes, he did, yes.
He's brilliant, actually, because he came into Wasps and revolutionised rugby, full stop. And under him are about seven people.
Yeah.
And those seven people have gone off and have become heads of conditioning in rugby, and then moved on to head of conditioning in other sport, and under them have spawned, and everyone's been a disciple of Craig White. And he obviously then finished, did the Lions, went off kind of do the yoga treats, went off to the other side of the world, kind of rediscovered himself, come back in, is now doing a real kind of work on mentoring, mental mindset, performance. He was the kind of the mastermind behind Uruguay beating Fiji in terms of their stuff. So he's a genius, but, you know, like he was a small, fiery man, very much like...
He was, but from the north.
From the north,
but from the north. And it couldn't be any more different now.
No.
So, like, when I went to Kenya, Whitey came in and did the audit with me on the S&C, and the guy that came in that we found was Chris Brown, was mentored under Whitey. Now, then came with me with Kenya. We turned them into absolute kind of Spartan warriors.
Yeah.
And then Brownie came to America and now runs the women's program. He's now the head coach of the women's program. But again, he's another disciple of Whitey. You know, I mean, he's a special character.
Yeah.
You know, and he's like he was proper angry. I mean, he wasn't just angry. I mean, he was kind of out of control angry. But now he couldn't be farther down the other end of the spectrum.
Gone Zen.
Yeah, he's like this.
He's still got it in him though.
Yeah.
Never underestimate that. You know what I mean? Everyone always goes Zen, but they still. You know, leopard doesn't change his spots. He's still fiery. I reckon you cross him, like Matt. Do you fucking want some?
Deal with it. So, what do you remember? So, when you first met Hask, he was one of these lumps who could lift the tin, but not necessarily run further than the.
He was a young man back then as well. You see, and. Like, typical with Hask as well, he was always trying to... Like, the thing about James is he wasn't bothered about what he was weak at. He wanted to get better.
Yeah.
So the reality is, my hands are not good enough. So he put himself in the spotlight. I want to do sevens. He's just come back from England 21s. Mm.
Yep.
And, you know, he's battling in the back row at WASP, which was a tough class to try to break into.
Electrodes on your bollocks on the first
day. Well, possibly. Yeah.
Well, you're Johnny O'Connor. Johnny O'Connor, Joe Worsley, Dan Leo,
Paul
Volley,
Lawrence. I would say Scribbs, but not Scribbs.
Not Scribbs, forget Scribbs. John Clark, Mark Locke.
James, Reesey and Crofty.
Yeah.
All from the 21s, and they wanted to kick on and work their hands. And back then, the sevens was a pathway, but you had to take yourself out of your comfort zone. James had to make some adjustments. So we actually took you guys to Amsterdam.
Yeah.
And Hillsy as well.
Yeah, Hillsy, yeah.
And Hillsy, Mike Hillsy was the 21s open side at the time.
I was a six, Mike was the seven because Reesey
was up.
He was ahead of us,
He was up a year. And
number Croft. Eight was it Croft? Crofty might have been there. There was another younger guy. Oh, Mark Hopley. Oh, no, he came. Mark, there's a few guys like that came in.
Sorry, Hask to Amsterdam.
Yes.
Yeah.
Part of it is the touring as well, so you have to teach them how to tour.
Then you had to play five games on the first day. Yeah. Was it four on the second?
No, four on the first day, then you go into a second group and then you go semi-final.
So four sevens games, right? Obviously playing to a certain way. You're battered, right, from all the games. So that the night of the final, or the day of the final, I'm so tired. I'm like, I can do this. He's like, you can, you're soft. Like, gave me a coffee, everything else that. And then we end up playing out of our skin, winning the game, fired in caffeine. And then... Do you remember after the final, Mike calls me over and he's like, oh, I've had a phone call from England, from Andy Robinson. And I'm thinking he's taking the piss here because the first time I got called up by the sevens by Joe Lydon to do that Young England sevens, you remember, he used to do Henley and something else. He called me up and it's Joe Lydon here, I'd like to call you up. I was like, fuck off, put the phone down.
How many times does that happen in sports?
Because I thought there was no way he's calling me up. And then he called me over and he goes, Andy Robinson wants to talk to you about, you know, we might have to pull you out, they want to play. I was like, what are you talking about? He goes, they're thinking about putting you against the Barbarians. And then I was in training Monday with the Barbarians or 2 days later that was my first game, came off the bench against the Barbarians at Twickenham for England.
Never looked back.
And hairs, he got sacked and then that was it.
Hairs on the chest.
Yeah. But it was intense though, wasn't it?
We used it because...
Do you like a bit of the old school in what you do?
Back then it was part of it. I think it's very different now. I still think there's a time where you have to allow the boys to be boys and you need to let them let loose. I think they've... Unfortunately now, with social media and things like that, you've got to be very, very careful and you've got to protect the boys. So, you know, we will have times... And they just have to be sensible. They have to be more aware. There are different things you have to be aware of now, which you didn't have to be back then. But I still think there's a big part about at the right time, at the appropriate time, team bonding. I think things have changed now in terms of, they call it in America, hazing. You can't, you know, you can't force those to participate that don't want to participate. And I think people are more open to that as long as they are joining in with making a fool of himself, even if it doesn't mean whatever it may be. But
me, did you love it as a player?
I loved it, but honestly, I cannot underestimate. No, I loved it. I found it hard to just because it was, you know, dodgy hotels, no food. You know, you're playing four games in one day, five games on the last day, and these are, you know, 7 each way. The finals 10 minutes each way, and you are so tired.
Yeah.
And you're trying to balance. Obviously, you're trying to play to a certain standard. You're trying to impress the guys. They are very professional about what they do, even though it's funny. So you're laughing hysterically between things. That's when we found out Terry Sands had had, I think one of his children, obviously one of his children.
What's Terry Sands' background?
Sandsy,
I don't know.
He was just an angry prop that played local rugby, but passionate about rugby. I came across him when I played for the Water Buffaloes back in the early 90s. And then our relationship and our bonding, obviously.
So, but what did he do? What part of the trio did he play with you?
He was the manager. So, basically, logistics.
Got you.
Getting shit done. There's a deal to be done. He's your man. Right. He made shit happen. And on the Seventh Circuit, when he managed England, it's not like a 15s trip where logistically you can map out everything for the next 3 weeks. Literally, stuff goes wrong and you've just got to improvise and adapt and you've got to find a way. And it's no good going, well, it's not in this manual. It's not.
Yeah.
Manual out the window. It's find a way to make sure that the boys have got what they need and get where we need to get to.
Got you.
So, imagine, he's a bit like Del Trotter, a big Del Trotter in terms of, like, the owner of Samurai, obviously very successful business, to and fro to China, always coming back, it was always a little deal, you know, and he would be brilliant at his the organisation stuff, but he was also a great character.
Yeah. Right.
So you've got Geezer take the piss all the time, Billis take the piss all the time, Terry take the piss all the time. So the atmosphere in camaraderie was brilliant. You were having a great time. You were doing good stuff on the field. Yeah. But that was when we found out that Terry had had a grandson or grandchild. It had been born Ginger. So everyone was getting into him about being Ginger. So they reckon he spent all of his fees on hair dye. And as soon as his kid would come out, they dyed it blonde from the early days because he wouldn't admit it. We were like, Terry, it's all right. You've got a ginger kid, mate. It's all right. It's all right. So I haven't. You're like, Terry, you have, you have. He goes, I'm dying it. You know.
Amazing.
It was just really good stuff. And Phil, you know, his foresight and that, and the way he used to play and his detail around that was pioneering back then as well. You know, just his attention to detail. You know, I learned more. You know, kicked off from Samurai, went to Dubai, was the first
one. Dubai and George with us first time. Yeah.
And just even things like there may be such a better player about, you know, the leg tackle, getting back to your feet, competing for the ball. When you're in a 15s team and you're playing, you might do hands in the warm up if you're lucky. You know, we were doing full length of the field, you know, up and down in George, 20 metre spin passes off both hands, working, you know, making sure you don't check the runner, doing extra bit of breakdown stuff. So leg tackles, getting to your feet, counter rucking. You know, being able to look after a ruck with one person, but then having the engine to keep doing it. And I remember in the very first game in Dubai, I put the lid on by the old scrum cat, right? It was hot. Luckily, it wasn't as hot as it could have been because it had been raining a little bit. And Crofty and I were, obviously, you have certain defensive systems. So you use a touchline, or you did back in the day, as your help. So guy's going. And the idea is you can back off a little bit. You close the door on him. So the guy gets blocked in. I remember this guy, I was so tired after they'd had the ball for 2 minutes. The guy just ran past me and everything in my body wanted me to tackle him. I couldn't. I just honestly watched him, like me and like Crofty, like dead behind the eyes, just watching this guy just run round us. And I was like, Crofty, yours? And basically nothing happened. We couldn't. When you're so tired, you can't do anything. And it was the weirdest thing because even in 15s, the worst game, you have something about you. Yeah. But when you've gone 2-3 minutes, you know, I remember the Army, we once played the Army in the Young England thing at Henley. They kept the ball for 5 minutes. By the end of it, by the end of it, they stepped, I just fell over. I was happy just to have a rest, to have a lie down, because you're out on your feet. And that was a big wake-up call. So the lid came off, because I felt like I was dying. You know, you feel like you're strangled, you can't breathe. And that was a massive eye-opener for me, that. It was horrific.
That's resilience as well, you know, and being able to go to the dark places, which you don't encompass in 15s, you go to different dark places there. So, you know, again, just valuable lessons and learning curves for young men, both on the pitch, off the pitch.
Yeah.
And like I said, when it was time to work, it was time to work. So all excuses go out the door. And that, you know, that was the thing that we're, again, teaching younger players to differentiate between the two. So know your limitations, know your expectations, know yourself, then manage yourself accordingly.
Mm.
Those are delivered probably in a very different way nowadays.
Yeah.
But they still stand true.
Yeah.
If you want to become the best version of yourself as a rugby player.
I want to ask you about you as a coach. And, and it's been a phenomenal journey in that regard. But I'm interested as to how much your playing career has shaped you as a coach. Now, how do you look back on yourself as a player?
Well, average, being blunt. I mean, I was all right, but I was ahead of my time because I was the only scrum half that couldn't pass, that played nine. I played with Wasps with Gommers and Andrew Gommersall and Martin Wood. You know, Martin Wood was an exceptional passer of the ball. Gommers was blue-eyed boy, come through the ranks, 18s, 21s, blah, blah, blah. So I rocked up from South East London, you know, because I was at Wasp as a youngster. I went to Blackheath to get game time because I got so far at Wasp, but back then there was only two subs. Yeah. You either sat on the bench or didn't get on or you played second team. So I was like, I want to go and play.
Yeah.
So I went and played at Blackheath for 4 years and then came back. But by then, Gomersall was in the England scrum half. So I had a right old tussle with Gomersall, knocked him out. You had a young Martin Wood coming through. Then you had three of us going hammer and tong the whole time. So the reality is none of us really got a proper... we didn't. And that was good and that was bad, but, you know, dependent on what side of the coin you landed on. And it was a very different time. So I was a running nine. So that's why I was earmarked to be a sevens player. And I did well and represented England in the sevens stuff. But back then it was looked upon very differently, which is what pissed me off and made me go into the coaching side, is that we went to the World Cup in 2001 and we had Sampson, we had Joe Worsley, we had a proper decent Saki, you know, we had proper wheels. Yeah. And literally, we met the night before, we flew out to Argentina, we were playing three full metal games in 40 degrees heat the day before we were playing the tournament against Georgia with a coach that wanted to play the same way. Like, play down the channel. And it was like, fuck this. This is shit. Right. So, you know, we've got Josh Lucy and they're going, well, what are you going to do about it, Mike? What are you going to say? You know what Josh is like from the back. What are you going to do about it, Mike? What are you going to do about it? And I'm like, so I'm having a conversation saying, mate, this isn't working. And I'm at loggerheads, meant to be skippering the team. I'm captaining the team. Then he's got upset with me and angry because I've spoken out. He's dropped me. They lose the game. They bring me back in. And it's like, you know, we ended up putting up a proper fight against New Zealand in the quarterfinal, losing 19-5 to a rampant Jonah Lomu who pissed it and won it.
Oh.
But that inspired me to go, you know what? That's not how it needs to be. That's not how it should be. And that's like for younger players where sevens can be part of that development pathway, which is how it was positioned back then when James played. It got me into it. So I was an all right player, but I had to work hard at what I had and what I did. And I always had a perspective because I was part of that crew that worked and played.
Yeah.
So even back when in the Wasp days, when you know the likes of Shawsey and Scribbs are off to Nando's, the rest of them are going to go and play PlayStation. I went into the West End and continued doing chart surveying.
Is that what they're calling it now? Yeah. The West End. I've done some chart surveying.
Surveying of something. Yeah, yeah.
Just because I knew it wasn't going to last forever.
Yeah.
And I was already kind of planning for what was coming afterwards. And maybe that took me a little bit of focus away from concentrating fully on my rugby. And again, Genge last week was saying, I want to do these things, but not at the expense of. So, you know, you pay your money, you take your choice, they're the choices. And I've ended up probably being better on the coaching side than as a player, but kind of position myself as somebody that molds himself around a player.
Yeah.
And the player doesn't mold around me, I mold around the player and say, how can I make you the best version of you? Not just as a rugby player, but as a man. And that's kind of been my mantra, was with England, with the younger group, with Kenya, who had nothing, and now with what we're doing with America, it's you've got more of a responsibility, not just as a coach to make them the best version of themselves on the rugby pitch, but also off the pitch.
Yeah.
You know, we've started things like internship programs and so forth, which had nothing to do with rugby, but they'll make them better versions of them, which hopefully transfers onto the rugby pitch.
Yeah. Quickly, in a nutshell, why did Quinn's not work?
Fucking hell. Oh, my God.
Is that quickly in a nutshell? Or
well,
this
is typical me as a young man. Like, I was in contract negotiations with Smelly, with Nigel, Melville, and I thought he was fucking about and he was messing me about.
Something like what's the fuck around contract.
And I was like, you know, and the reality is I knew what I wanted to get to and it wasn't a lot of money, but it was going to enable me to continue for another 2 years and survey. And we fucked about. And in the end, like, Quinns came in and said, well, we want you to come and sign for this. And I'm like, fucking Quinns. Oh, my God. I've got to face Volley. I've got to face Shawsey. This is going to be a nightmare. And in the end, I just said to Shawsey and Voles, and I was like, mate, I'm fucking going, mate. I think he's taking the piss out of me. So, and I went. And as soon as I signed and I went, and I'd been there a month, there were some good people at Quinns and there was some not, but it's a very different Quinns to the one that is now. Yep. It was back then, it was very much them and I fucking hated it. And 2 months in, I was like, you dickhead.
Why? What was it about?
Well, because they were very individualistic. There was a number of those top players who were there for themselves. They were captained by David Wilson, the Aussie 7, who was brilliant. And I had some great friends there, but there were some boys there that were there just for them. And everything revolved around them and they weren't really interested in doing the best for Quinns, which was the way that Wasps operated.
Yeah.
You were selfless for the cause. Mm.
Yeah.
And 6 months later, I phoned Nigel. I was like, I fucked up, mate.
Can I come home?
I fucked up, mate. And he said, I didn't think you'd go. And I was like, well, yeah, but I thought you was mucking. He said, well, I thought you was. So in the end, I was like, oh, fuck this. So I had a two-year deal. I got out of that second-year deal, and I went back and I signed for WASF.
Did you get what you wanted?
And I got what I wanted because I wanted to, the important thing for me as well was finishing where I wanted on my terms, because I was always going to go back to Savannah. I didn't want to be a rugby player just to be a rugby player, because if I would have gone abroad after WASP, but I didn't. I wanted to finish on my terms and go, do you know what? I'm not hanging around to be a rugby player just to say I'm a rugby player. I've done all I'm going to do. I've gone as far as I can go.
Yeah.
And then I ended up going back to Savannah, and then I had to ask for 12 months off because they want me to go back and do England and do the sevens, but to be a player coach. So it was a bizarre kind of 12, 18 months, but learning curve, you know
what
I mean? You got to get it wrong to get it right. Well, I certainly lived up to that.
Proper merry-go-round.
It's good that you can turn around and say, and actually you put your hand up and said it and didn't suffer. I think that's important, you know, to be able to say, actually, look, I went for it, I tried it. Because I think, you know, you often see it with the players who go to France. You know, it's actually, I think it's particularly one country, but I'm not going to say where these guys go from that.
Which country?
I'm not going to say it, but they go to what, from one part of the country. They go there and they only ever last a year or 2 years because they realise they made the wrong decision or it doesn't suit them. Because a lot of people forget, and this is probably a message for a lot of the young players, is that everybody gets caught up with the financials, but actually that's probably third down the list. It's, are you going to go there and enjoy it? Is it going to make you a better player? Can you or your family, or do you want to be part of it? Are they going to look after you? And then the money comes in.
Yeah.
But everyone gets caught up with the money, and these people sometimes don't even look into it and don't realise. So that was always my thing. I looked at it and I went, well, is this going to challenge me? And then the money, you know, the money's important, but, you know, there was times when I was at Stad, and I went there for the right reasons, but in that first year when I had three coaches in 1 year and the bloke that came in was abusing me every day, I just had to sit. I sat in my bathroom and it literally became about the money for that one season. Then Michael Chesky came in and it changed. Let's get through it.
Yeah,
but a lot of people suffer that. But it's fair play. And also, you got to go back and do it.
It was great. And I went back, and all the crew were there, and it was like, I'd never been away. And it was nice.
You must have had quite an initiation coming back in there.
Oh, well, sometimes the family of the WASP give you a little bit of forgiveness, because I blame Smelly.
So he took it.
But I think that's one of the things. I think I was very lucky, and I genuinely believe that I would never have had the career I'd had if I hadn't been at WASPs.
With that crew.
Man,
the learning
people, and being,
the learning
been
curve.
Accepted, though. I think you will probably agree that the early days of WASP, they actually actively wanted personality. So, for example, if I'd signed for Leicester out of school, there would have been a complete clash of personalities, complete clash of demeanour, complete clash of senior players. I went to WASS and the senior players and the people around the club and, like, you know, the Rigbys who come back, and those characters and Dean Ryans, they all part of this family. And a WASS player is always a WASS player, and you always have that kind of distinct thing. And I genuinely believe that I was so lucky, and I would never have had the adventures I'd had if I hadn't done that.
This would be a very different show if you'd gone to Leicester.
Imagine that.
Be monosyllabic.
Yeah.
Yes. No. No, yes.
I phoned Jono. What did he say?
The brow came down.
Yeah. John would have, you know, I told you, John, before when he said he used to say, when his England coach, he used to look at me and I'd be laughing, and I just feel his eyes burning into me. He goes, I would have fucking loved to play the good game. He's another one who's like seething. Made a lot of people seethe who just wanted to. There's a lot of people who wanted, just missed out on filling me in.
I wonder if Jono voted for you and I'm a celebrity, get me out.
He would have to admit that he'd watched it. It's never happening.
Never going to happen. You are watching and listening House of Rugby together with Guinness, with me, Alex Payne, alongside James Haskell and the USA Sevens coach, an all-round geezer that is, Mr. Mike Friday. It's very nice to have you with us. Still to come, we're going to talk Sevens, the Olympics. We've got an NFL-related perfect pour. But this week on Liquid Football, Steve Sidwell told Kelly Cates about the song that the fans used to sing to him from the terraces. Have a listen to this.
I like going in with the punters as well. But I went recently, I took my middle son Rocco, his Sunday league team, Chips did, for a Christmas sort of present as such. And we was in there, it was a Brighton game, and the fans started singing my song, which is, you know, it's...
What's that?
Yeah. Come on then. Started it, so come on.
It's Stevie Sidwell, you are the love of my life. Oh, Stevie Sidwell, I'll let you shag my wife. Oh, Stevie Sidwell, I want ginger hair. And literally, when I was playing, like, they was all singing it, and I'd look into the crowd and there'd be men, like, singing it, and their wife would be just like right there, or some of them like getting them, just, like things like that.
They singing it as well.
Yeah, some of them, yeah. But when I took the boys the other week, they were all singing it, and the team were cracking up. They were laughing so much, and I was like, oh my God.
They're at the perfect age for that as
well. Perfect age, yeah, 11 years old, yeah.
So they're just like, oh, we shouldn't really know this.
So that is Liquid Football every week with Kelly Cates and the team, and you can get that in your earballs and your eyeballs on Mondays. A little bit more about you, just about how you got into coaching. Is it true your coaching career started in football than rugby? What made that up?
No. I didn't play rugby at school. I was a football player.
What position? What kind of player? Yeah, football.
Funny enough, right foot.
You were the ball, weren't
right
you?
Right foot, yeah. Right foot, and then made me play left midfield. Purely and simply because I just run all day.
What was your team?
Ravenswood. Ravensbourne. Worst week of my life at school. I just went to a football school. I used to just play on a Sunday rugby down at the local club, Blomley Rugby Club. That's where I used to play. I was into soccer, but I wasn't quite good enough.
So how did you get from football to rugby?
Well, just playing on a Sunday, and then I...
Sorry, tapped you up and said you could do this.
I was playing... No, I got sent to the Kent school trials as an 18-year-old, right? And I was at Alpington College by then, which is a poor excuse for a college. And literally, I rocked up and they were like, what school are you? I was like, oh, Alpington College. And literally got just cast to the side. And I'd already got into Kent under-19s as a 17-year-old, but I was too young to play for Kent 19s. So I had to go to the schools. And I got nothing. And then a year later, I went back to that Kent 19s. And then Wasps saw me and were following me. And then I was at the London stuff with Lawrence. And Eileen, his mum, got talking to my mum saying, you need to bring your boy to Wasps. So it was Eileen on the recruitment trail again.
Eileen was amazing. Eileen just pushed me, you know, God rest. So she was amazing. What a character she was. Lawrence's mum was one of the best, nicest person. She was like, she just...
Did she know you?
Yeah, so I used to...
She knew everyone.
Yeah, she knew everyone, but she was brilliant. So she, you know, she would... when I first came to Wasps as like a kind of a fan as a 14, 15-year-old watching, getting to meet Lawrence Salerio's mum... was, you know, a beat.
Better than meeting Lawrence.
She a better chat than Lawrence. And, you know, like, character-wise, she was just incredible. Such a strong-willed woman. Yeah. You know, like, really amazing. Passionate about supporting. Like, one of those people, knew everything, wasn't scared to tell coaches, to tell everyone. And she actively, you know, Lawrence would try to walk past, and she'd be like, Lawrence, come here, say hello to this, you know, and she would give him, she gave me one of his jackets. And I was just, she put so much time into me, and then and always support me through my career. She was a brilliant, brilliant lady. She was incredible. She went to her funeral. It was very, you know, it was really, obviously sad that she passed away, but she was brilliant, and she would be not frightened to order anyone around. And she befriended my mum, same thing, you know, when you get into this rug world, you know, because Lawrence, probably one of the greatest to ever do it, and one of the most famous people ever. And you meet his mum's like, well, you know, I tell him to do this, and you see her bollocking Lawrence, and you're like, fucking hell. And she's telling my mum, this is what you need to do with him, this is what you need to do with him. It's amazing.
That's how she was. And again, like, you know, we played in the Middlesex Sevens. He just won that World Cup 91 with the Sevens.
Oh, yeah.
And then we played as all the youngsters, me, Volley, LD, Scracie, we played in the Middlesex Sevens that won that year.
93
at Murrayfield. And he had a riverboat then, back then.
He so lived on a houseboat.
He lived on a houseboat. Him and Scracie lived on a houseboat. Yeah. And like always, I was over that weekend, and his mum was on the phone, and she's critiquing him on the phone, and he's like, yes, mum. Yes. Who else is there? Well, Mike said, oh, didn't he do well? Scracie was, oh, didn't he do well? And we're like, oh, we're in the clear.
Thank God.
She would bollock you, wouldn't she?
Oh, yeah.
I've seen her. Who did I see? I saw her once bollocking. Someone came to a game. I don't know if it was Andy Robinson or Clive, or somebody came, or one
Jack
of the
Rowell, she had a pop of Jack Rowell about not picking Lowell.
You need
to pick my boy.
She literally cornered him. Cornered him, was like, were you not picking him, you know, so-and-so. Like, mate, she was fierce, brilliant. But I wonderful.
Brilliant, brilliant lady.
Key part of what makes Wasps Wasps. I want to move on to your coaching career. I'm going to throw it out there. So you mentioned about the Quins, and it was a bit edgy. There's always quite a lot of fire around Mike Friday. Is that a fair comment or not? If you look at where you've been and what you've done... A little bit of fire around England, a little bit of fire around Kenya. Yeah, I'm not saying this is always on you, but there is always a bit of fire. Is that purely coincidence? Or
no, it's part of me. Yeah. I think, especially the younger me. I was very, very passionate and very, very player-centred. And as a younger man, as a coach, I would only see it one way.
Yeah.
And through making sure that I did the best I could to develop the players.
Yeah.
And sometimes I would say that I got things wrong in the wider context. And I wanted the typical small man syndrome, right? Wanted to win every battle.
Yeah.
Just in case somebody said I was short. And literally, in my, you know, I remember, I look back at when I coached England and some of the fire that's attached to that, and some of it I regret.
Yeah,
and I think if I had my time again, I would do differently with a number of people. There's some of it that I was very passionate about and called right. Yeah. I still think that, but I think there's also, I think there's always a better way. When I, there was a better way to do certain things.
Yeah.
Kenya was just a whole different experience.
Where were you based in Kenya?
I was based in Nairobi,
yeah,
along the Ngong Road, opposite the KIU offices. I mean, mate, the boys were phenomenal. Like, really? I mean, the beast, like Spartan 300, what we turned them into, like Ambaka, Amonde, Oscaruma. Just literally, we gave them some supplementation and proper food, and they just would ping muscles from everywhere. But the board, there's something that happens in Africa, like when you get this title director, then all of a sudden you become a very different person, and it's very corrupt. And yes, everybody can have a slice of cake, but not before me.
Right.
And it became, injustice is a big Achilles heel for me, and more so as a younger man, and that's the fire.
Yeah,
I think what I've learned as you grow as a coach is you can be, still be true to the players and still mould yourself around them, but you need a perspective and a reality, and you've got to realise you can't win every battle, but you can still protect the players to be, to allow them to become what they are. So I would probably say you're fair and you're right on that.
Have you put the fires out now? I mean, are the fires out at the RFU? Do you have correspondence and chats there?
Well, it's a tire fire, isn't it? It burns for 100 years.
Have you played, I mean, the reality is, I don't forget, like, you know, let's just, Amor's, what he's doing now. Amor was my captain.
Absolutely.
You know, I mentored him
Eddie
in his
Jones
early
just
coaching.
Moved him up to the...
Yeah, so, Conor O'Shea's back there, and, you know, I got on well with Conor, and, again, we were doing the legend stuff in the summer out in Sardinia. So the people, let's just say, where the fires probably were, they have moved on as well.
Yeah.
You know, I visited Kenya back in December, probably the first time in a long time.
Because I was going to ask you about that. Because the reason I asked the question, I remember when you met years ago, but we did hours and hours and hours of Seven Studios in Sky. I've never seen a man eat more chocolate.
Yeah. Well, you have, Ollie Phillips.
Ollie Phillips probably just edges it, but
he was obsessed with that chocolate. Unbelievable.
Scenes.
You know, like when we were living in France, I was on a strict diet looking after Rick.
Yeah.
And he'd be like, oh, just what you know, just.
What do you call him? You called him Augustus Gloop.
Augustus Gloop. Yeah, that's what he was.
Michael Checker called him the accountant, didn't he? He said, like, accountant running around, like a 60-year-old accountant. He'd come in and be like, oh, just got a little something for you. Pull out chocolate, but that's not part of the diet. But then what he did is, because he's insidious, he'd get in under your skin.
Yeah.
So every four games I'll be doing it, you know, or sorry, on the Friday before a Saturday game. He's a chocoholic. Yeah. Always, he's pulling chocolate out of everywhere.
Learned from this man here. But the Kenya, because I can remember talking to you about the Kenya thing.
Yeah.
And I mean, there was so much, it was an amazing story.
Yeah.
But I remember your frustration off the back of it. And did that get nasty, nasty, or did it
No, it didn't get nasty. I think the reality is it's the only job I've had to walk away from.
That's right.
Like, proper walk away from is because I was waking up to, like, 70, 80 emails a day, and it was one half of the board trying to do the other half of the board over with crass politics and using the white kid in the middle.
Right.
And I had to set the boys down in Sri Lanka, and I had six of my senior boys out there at this Colton Sevens Invitational stuff, and I just said, lads, I can't. I want to see it through because I was loving it. I was enjoying it. We'd done so well in a year, and I just said, I can't do it. It's going to make me ill. But there was tears. I mean, there was real tears. I mean, these boys are the big lads. I mean, Amonde don't cry, right? Yeah. Trust me, he doesn't. You see him. But these boys, you know, we had a real strong bond, and I had a real strong sense of parenting, fatherly figure with them. But I just said, I can't carry on. So that was a tough call for me.
Yeah.
But I had to do it.
Do you keep in touch with them?
Yeah.
From the bit?
So I still see, like, they're still on the circuit. Most of those boys have gone on, and they carried that mantra on.
Yeah.
And, you know, they won Singapore 2 or 3 years later. They're all senior men now. They're all coming to them. Their swan song will be Tokyo 2020. But they're good, hardworking, honest rugby players. You know, they're good men.
It's so WASPs. I was just going to very quickly say, it's so WASPs almost to fight with the authority, but to have the most incredible, which you do, you have the most incredible buy-in from the players that you work with.
Think,
England, Kenya, US.
I try not to fight with the authority now. Well,
as a young man.
I was going to ask something, because obviously we did the seven stuff, and when you're a player, you're so focused on yourself, and you know, I'm quite self-interested at the best of times anyway. So you don't really look at coaching. But obviously, when you start, I do business stuff, you start looking at different people. So I read Ben Ryan's book about that, and he one of the things he references was your desire to fight injustice, you know, about always feeling agreement. But Michael Checker was exactly the same.
Yeah.
And actually, when they asked me about it in the World Cup, I said he loves to have had something happen or someone, because that's what he rallies the boys around, yeah. because he's a player-centred coach. And I think sometimes that's a good thing, where you're, because you've got the interest of the coaches, sorry, interest of the players in front of you. You want to get the best out of them. And when somebody upsets that or you feel injustice, you feel it even more because you have such a passionate bond, even though there is a clear... you're in charge. I wondered, you said you've moved away from that. How have you moved away from that? Because I think sometimes it can be really important, yeah, as a coach. Because when Checker used to say to us, go over and do this, you know he would be the first one. I saw him throw a cameraman down the stairs.
Yeah.
We were fired up. Do you know what I mean? He's the first one to go in there. And I would expect pretty similar from you, you know?
You don't lose that fire, but I think what you do with age or what you do with experiences is that you consciously, if I decide to go, I decide...
When was the last time you went?
Probably Dubai and Cape Town, because of trying to deal with these format stuff where, again, it's frustrating because it's not in the best interest of the game and so forth. But if you consciously decide to go, that's not a problem. I think when I look back at especially some of the England stuff as a younger guy, and when I look back to my time in business as well with the surveying firm when I was running teams, where, again, you had to deal with a lot of stuff, is that there's times where I went and it wasn't my choice. I think that's a young man's trait.
Right.
Especially if you're driven like that way. And I know I am driven like that way. So it's just being kind of consciously aware.
So you've harnessed it in the right way now. Yeah. So you use it when you need it, but exactly. It doesn't come out unnaturally.
You can't change who you are, and you've always got to be authentic and true to yourself. But there's what I have learned as well over the time through dealing with numerous things in the business world and dealing with sport is that there's more than one way to skin a cat. Do you know what I mean? And you've got to use those tools to get where you need to get to for the best interest of the crew.
Yeah, yeah.
And the bigger the organisation, the more you have to realise that you have to be patient and careful about how you plot that path. Yeah.
Because Sean Edwards was a bit like that. I remember, you know, he would always be like, you know, I mean, I tell you this too, when this guy once came in for the RPA, he's great, but came in and was like, did a talk about half an hour, 40 minutes about player burnout. I don't know if he told this story, player burnout. Everyone's like listening, go, Christ, you probably do overtrain a bit. All the lads are like, Sean Edwards, everyone left the room.
Right.
But Sean went, right, lads, get back in that fucking room. He saw it there, go, right, player burnout. Right. You're paid to be fucking rugby players. If you want to burn out, you fuck off now. No one in here is burnt out. You burn out, James. Like, absolutely not. You burn out. Right. Shut the fuck up. There's no such thing as burn out. Get out, right? Obviously, thoughts have moved on, but it was amazing. This RPA's guy shitting himself in the corner because he completely poo-pooed it, destroyed it, because all the lads were like ready to start marching on the fact we were overtraining.
Taking
it. Like, it doesn't exist, lads. Fucking bollocks, right? But I remember Sean would like, if ever players were dangerous or whatever, or things, he would hate that. I remember we went down to Bath one day to play and it'd been frozen, right? And they didn't have under pitch heating. I mean, they got lucky to have a standing bath and the whole wreck. But they had it all water and it'd frozen, right? The pitch was solid. Yeah. And they were trying to play the game because I think Bath needed the points or vice versa. Yeah. So Sean's, the referee's gone to inspect the pitch, right? And it's like this. And the Bath guys are leaning over going, well, you know, we could probably do that. And Sean's like, no, mate, that's dangerous. Like, player welfare, right? That's dangerous. Not play. Referee's like, umming and ahhing. Matt Banahan comes ice skating over the top of the field because it's that frozen. And Sean's like, mate, look at fucking Banahan ice skating on the field. We're not playing. And all the Bath coaches are looking around going, Banahan, you dickhead.
Get back in the changing room.
Yeah, but Sean was brilliant at that. Except when, who was it, came to play us at Adams Park and... the under-pitch heating got switched off and it froze.
You had injury problems.
Yeah, we had injury problems. Yes. We wouldn't have finished. Sale came all the way down. Mysteriously, the under-pitch heating got turned off, so the pitch was frozen. I think they were out watering it the night before. Called off the game. We played them the following week, battered them, and then got through and won the final. But there was a lot of, like, it was almost like Flaggate. Remember Flaggate with Bath, the flammable flags?
Yes.
That was a low point.
That was very low for the game.
I love that.
I'd love to talk Kenny with you, but we're sort of slightly running out of time. I'd love America, US.
Yeah.
Is it the sleeping giant that everyone thinks it is, or is it just sleeping?
It could be. I think, look.
Genuinely,
it could be. I think.
What's it going to take to properly awaken?
The long and the short of it is that they need rugby to be positioned in the high schools. Like, the golden age to learn rugby is 13 to 18.
Yeah.
And the reality is that, unlike any other country in the world, college scholarships drive ambition. Rugby will never be an NCAA sport because whatever you do for the men, you have to do for the women. And 54 of those spots are taken up with American football. So all your best athletes will chase college scholarships with football.
Yeah.
So we are currently tracking five or six that are as you would say, a college scholarship's D1A, D2 playing football.
What does that mean?
Well, they're either a D1 college or a D2 college. The reality is they're shit hot athletes.
Right,
that play rugby between the ages 11 and 18, but they're chasing the NFL, chasing the money. Why wouldn't they?
Yeah.
And they're also chasing a free college education. So they'll be sleeping for 4 years. If they don't make it, we got touch points then that they can hopefully come back to us. So there's a couple of wide receivers, there's a couple of running backs, things like that. And they're like the Nate Ebner blueprint, where it takes me 6-9 months for a really good rugby player that's not played for 4 years to bring it from the back of the head to the front of the head, then they can play. But if you're a crossover athlete that only starts playing the game at college at 19, the only place you can probably play is on the wing.
Right.
And that's what Perry and Carlin were. So you imagine the athletic capability in America, that if they played in high school and they just played one term that complemented football or basketball, and they loved it and they fell in love with it, which they would. Now, only 1% will ever make it to the NBA or the NFL. The other 99% that have played, that are all athletically gifted, they come out the other end. All of a sudden, you will have rugby mature athletes that will probably not mature like here in the UK and the Southern Hemisphere by the time they're 23, 24, might be 25.
Yeah.
But there's so many of them, it's a numbers game. And you lay that on top with wrestlers, which go to dark places that could be your props and things like that. It could be mental. That's on the men's side. The women's side, they could mop up. If it becomes a varsity sport because they've got to, with the NCAA, because they've got to couple it with...
What is NCAA?
Sorry. It's their National College Athletic Association, which if they get that blue tick where it gets recognised that it can be a varsity sport.
Yeah.
So they've got 54 spots with men. They've got to find a team sport for women. So if they can create rugby to do that, that's their free college scholarship. That means all the best athletes will just go for that.
Yeah.
Well, women's rugby is 20, 25 years behind from a professionalism from when we started in 95 to when they probably started 3 or 4 years ago. The athletic capability in America is ridiculous.
Mm.
So the opportunity is there, but for that to happen, there's a 20-year time lag.
Right.
So if they got given the 15s World Cup in, say, 31, which would be not the next one, the one after, and World Rugby got their strategy in place like they did for Japan 12 years ago, it's a real possibility. But
because the rumour is, it's obviously France inked in, potentially Australia, then the US is the one they're looking
for. So it would align, but that's no good if they don't work back and they don't invest, because it's going to take a massive investment in the community, the club game, to create the opportunities for these athletes to consider alternatives. They're never going to change their goals for being NFL and NBA, nor should they, but you don't...
But it's a second opportunity.
You don't need them to.
No.
And then you could create a proper front five athlete base. If you create a proper front five athlete base, you can play test match rugby.
Yeah.
If you haven't got front five, it don't matter how good your backs are or how good your back rows, they can't play.
Yeah. Quickly on a World Cup, would you do it across the entire states, or would you do it East Coast, West? Would you sort of localise it?
Well, I think the reality is, like, again, the states is so big, you don't actually need to hit every state. No. You just need to hit the rugby hotbeds. There's kind of 6 or 7 states. I mean, Texas is the size of France. So you create 6 or 7 state hotbeds.
Yeah.
The reality is you create what you need, and then the better players will gravitate to those states because they are very mobile in America. They're used to travelling and flying and going where they need to go, and they'll gravitate to the states that are user-friendly, and they'll do that at high school level as well.
Yeah.
So you don't need to hit all 50 states, and you'd be silly too. You need to go to where you're naturally strong: Southern California, Northern California, Utah, Massachusetts, Texas, Colorado.
Game on.
Exactly.
Absolutely fascinating. So there's obviously a huge potential in terms of the players. I know you like sort of harvesting information from other... I mean, you've got an amazing bed of coaches out there. Have you dipped into NFL, NBA?
Yeah, I obviously spent a bit of time with the Patriots. Not this year, as in a Welfrom.
So you've done time with Belichick. And...
Yeah, I went up there after Rio with Ebner. We went up there, spent some time there. Again, very, very
what
interesting.
What is that like?
Well, I mean, ridiculously how they learn. So again, you go into the offense room, you go into the defense room. The defense learn by pictures and video. The offense learn by words, mental, analytical and visual. And like,
what would you be, James? Pictures or words?
I would be... Pictures. I'd have to pictures and watch it, but I'd have to do it. You know, that's the thing. You know, like, learn the playbook. I could learn things. I can, obviously, because I can read. Best-selling author. Don't worry about it. But I can read and everything like that, and I could see the picture. I'd have to go through it. Yeah, I couldn't just see words and then just go out and do it.
That's but that's
that is extraordinary.
The offense boys, like Brady and all that mob, they literally... I did the defense one. It was interesting. You watched a video, a bit like me, a visual learner and things like that, but...
But they're X's and O's, you mean, the offence? Literally, diagrams?
No.
And...
written plays. And then what they do is they go up to the virtual room and they walk it. So they just walk the things. Yeah, I mean, it's very, very different, but because it's a very close skill orientated. And the problem is I've got Ebner going, what goes on in the offence room? I'm like, mate, you've been here 6 years. We don't know what goes on in the offence.
No crossover.
And then it's interesting. You walk in the offence room, right? And there was no chairs. I had to sit at the back. And it's all that, you know, that front line, the offence line. Mm. I mean, they're fucking giants. Mm. And I'm
like giant.
Literally, you can imagine me like Gulliver's Travels. I walk in there and I'm like, mate.
Walking between the legs.
There's an English bloke coming in here and he's going, these blokes. Literally, the first 15 minutes, they get all their work and they say, mate, you boys can go. You probably got to go and eat or something. Or, you know, they're going to lose their concentration. And then the brains trust of Brady, the running backs and the wide receivers.
Here, where was it? Yeah.
They all do their stuff and then they'll go up to the virtual team. They don't have the front line there because the front line are just going to stand there and block people. Yeah. And they walk through everything. And then they go out and they train for 2 hours, military, how they go. And then they come back in and they will then review everything. I mean, it's a long day, seven till nine at night if you're a rookie. And it's interesting. The one area which surprised me was their S&C. Like, you've got an hour, mate, get it done.
It's not as you think it is, isn't it? Like, I spoke to a couple of people.
Because I'll tell you why. Because they're like, if you don't do it,
you're gone, mate.
Well, you're gone because I've got 12 ready. One in 12 ready. It's not like...
But also, I always thought, because of the athletic prowess of NFL players,
yeah.
But actually, I was speaking to Wadey at the start, he said you don't get a lot of speed. So, for example, because you've got those long days, in terms of the intensive work on speed and footwork, you don't get naturally a lot of time to focus on it. So then you have to do it out of hours, but then it's very difficult to do it out of hours. So because I always perceived them as making them athletes, but it's more often than not, they're already ready-made.
That's the point.
Unbelievable athletes. And he's just tuning them up, yeah.
That's what I'm saying. You know, you get to college where about, you know, could rugby... Yeah. The athletic ability in the country is phenomenal. What they invest in them at high school.
Is it just because of the depth of...
It's numbers.
This is numbers.
It's the genetics, because if you think there's such a diverse... It's such a diverse place. You know, the islander population, the African-American population, the Hispanic population, as well as the standard white population. It's huge. So it's a numbers game. There's the athletic ability. And the way that they are invested in at high school, if they show potential in college, it's... I mean, I've been into some high school's facilities...
Better than any Premiership team going.
And some. Yeah. Like, better than, you know, and you go into some of the college ones, it's ridiculous.
But there's some of those college guys, 100,000 people watching a college game, 60, 70,000 to 100,000 people watching a college game.
They play for free because they finance the university. So, like, Virginia Tech, it's 120,000. I mean, it bounces. There's a Sandman, it just bounces.
But, you know, like, a whole town goes and watches one particular team. It's insanity, you know. And that's why it's always interesting when, you know, because they can't take any money. So, you know, because back in the day, your mum's mum would suddenly be driving around in a Range Rover. And, all, you know, but then they took a couple of Heisman trophies away, didn't they? I don't know if it was Michael Vick they took away, or they...
Reggie Bush,
got his... Heisman trophy taken away because they found he'd been boosted, I paid off, given money, given a trainer deal. But it is incredible. I that's the one thing I would love to have done is played, gone to college in America and played and actually been good, if I'd been good enough, got done, you know, something like that, played on that level. Because they are heroes. I mean, even then, you know, when they go into the NFL, make it,
clean hearts.
I mean, that's what makes what Wadey's doing just... phenomenal. And Shaggy, Alex Grant, I mean, fair play.
He's getting on all right, isn't he?
He's doing well, but I'm so excited to see what happens with Wadey next year if they do activate him, because his first two touches were
ridiculous.
Just box office. Like, even like my boys and the American boys who were waiting for him to trip up because they're like, you know, they've all done a bit of football. They're like, oh, fair play.
Really?
Yeah, fair play. I mean, the comedy bit was Wadey trying to run under the
stick. Yeah, I saw that. He ran around to make the conversion easier.
I love that. But also, you know, like, he would have got another touchdown because, you know, he, like, on that second one, when he beat everyone, he ran inside, but if he'd run on the outside, he had a blocker. Yeah. You're not used to that, because if you don't have that, he would have blocked him and he would have gone and scored another touchdown.
And that one would have been unreal.
Yeah, that would have been like champagne. You know, but, I mean, the first one was incredible. I'm excited to see it. But it's very interesting what you say, because... So much of people, rugby players over here, looked at NFL and go, oh, their S&C must be fantastic. But I remember talking to the guy that was a second row from Saracens. Yeah. Do you remember the big unit?
Landry, was it?
Remember what his name is now. But he was and he went over there and he said that the conditioning for him just completely went. He said, you know, their idea of a bit of fitness was shuttles, but nothing really. Like, because they, you know, he said that the worst it would ever get as if they did a quick play, drive, quickly go again, quickly go again. Because normally you shuffle on reset. Exactly. If you do four drives, people are blowing out of their arses.
I mean, have you ever seen Brady run?
No.
He's like a giraffe on ice. It's embarrassing when you watch him run.
Hayden Smith, yeah.
He came. He went back to Saturday.
Yeah, he did, yeah. Because I tried to do some NFL stuff.
Oh, did you?
I've not told you this. No? Yeah, so I basically met with NFL Europe, met with the NFL people, but I had to go and have knee surgery.
What stage of your career?
I was 25. It was before I was just about to leave the WAS. I'd just come back from WAS, 26 or something, and I basically decided that I was too old, A. B, I'd never played, it was too much of a risk, and I just ended up having patellar tendon surgery, so I didn't go and do it. But I explored it, went through it, spoke to Haysmith, he was lovely, spoke to an agent, did everything, started trying to meet people, but it just never worked out. I don't think I would have been any good at it, but I quite like the idea of just simplifying my game. Right, you just got to defend, read these plays, just hit people.
Yeah, it's perfect, phenomenal.
Did you have a cup of tea and a hobnob with Belichick, Brady?
It's interesting. Like, Belichick came in, we chatted. It was more the, I can't remember his name, the defense coach who's now since moved on to be a head coach. He just spent time with them. I mean, Belichick's very process driven, very, very nice.
Friendly, warm?
Friendly-ish in for him. I mean, if you watch his press conferences, that is him. Hugely analytical, no emotion, says how it is. When he addresses the team, you're left under no illusion where you stand.
Yeah.
And that's kind of their hierarchy, is that he very much is that detached figurehead, and the defence and the offence are they're like the assistant coaches who are you're right, mate, that's how they operate. And, you know, you see that in rugby. I struggle to operate like that. I can't dissect myself. I can draw a line with a player when we're having banter and when this is a serious conversation. Mm. And I think you can do that if you position it right.
Yeah.
I don't sense that with Belichick.
Yeah.
And how he addresses when coaches come in is very, very standardised, probably because he has to be.
Yeah.
He's a normal, he's knowledgeable. He loves his hoodies.
Yeah.
And he had a keen interest in what the rugby was doing.
So I was going to ask that. Did he ask as well as tell?
Yeah, more so because obviously Ebner had been with us.
Yeah.
So he became invested, and you know, Ebner off the back of that came back after the Olympics, got in the special teams all-star team. He got into that the year after. I mean, he had a hell of a year. He won the NFL, won the Super Bowl, came with us to the Olympics, and then went back and won another one. So yeah, and then he had the best year of his life after the Olympics, purely and simply because his conditioning base and how he'd been tailored meant he was actually in a very good place physically to go into that kind of backup season.
And what was he like as a rugby player? I mean, what is the difference between an NFL player who you plug in and a rugby player?
Well, this
comes
is the point. He is a rugby player that went to the NFL. So Nate's story is he was a rugby player till he was 17. Ohio State walk-on. He went to Ohio State and was a walk-on onto their team and then got his scholarship. He wasn't recruited.
Yeah.
And then he got himself in the draft because he was like I don't know what round he was in the draft of the Patriots, but they watched him, they picked him, and he had the right behaviours and the right traits. And he's, again, in special teams, he's able to do the defensive reads, a bit more of a decision-making role, which is more akin to rugby. And he's got a work ethic and a resilience through the traumas he's had in life that make him the person he is. I mean, he's a good man, he's an honest man. And like I say, it's interesting, the films certainly don't betray the Patriots and NFL players how they are. I mean, these boys are all business. On a training day, on the pitch, in the classroom, around the place, how they interact with one another and how they interact with people that are invited in to spend time with them. You know, very, very interesting insight for me, and a great organisation. Ebner is, he's the sort of person you'd want in your change room because you'd look him in the eye and you go, "You ready to go?" We're like, "Yeah, I'm ready to go. Where are we going?" And then he'd empty, come back, he'd back you up.
Yeah.
He'd support you. He'd make sure you didn't fall over. So, yeah, he's a good man.
It's interesting that you put him in such good shape that he was able to kick on with that pre-season and go again and turn up and do that, isn't it? Because a lot of them do off-season training, don't they? A lot of the training days. Some of them aren't allowed into the facility, but they're expected to do it.
Yeah.
But I can imagine going and doing, especially sevens, the discipline, how fit the engine, all the requirements, how that would make you sharper, and then go on and absolutely kill it.
Yeah.
What's your opinion?
Last week that he's the best coach you played under, one of the best coaches you played under. Why was that?
Just because I felt the attention to detail. I felt that the whole package of going into that seven circuit being, it's the core skills of the game. undiluted, yeah. right? But being there and being in a fun environment, which was the first thing, enjoying what I was doing, being taught and broken down and encouraged in a way that made me a better player, being constantly helped to be a better player, going out there and putting it into practice, then coming back to my team, you know, in a better, more confident place and actually testing myself. And playing rugby, you know, when you get into a premiership cycle, you play a Saturday, you have Sunday off, Monday you come in, you go round. There isn't a lot of time for player development because yeah. you're trying to win, because of relegation, because of the pressures and everything else. But with the Sevens, you know, even there was a build-up time to do that. And they just he did it very well, communicated very well, was very passionate, very honest about things, just created a good atmosphere. And I think, you know, you said it was a player-centred coach, and I think with Phil as well, you know, he's pretty uncompromising, Phil, you know, when he wants to be. But he played in a certain way. You know, remember he played as England in that Six Nations? He played like no hooker had ever played before.
Oh, did stuff 2000.
That, yeah, did stuff that like no other hooker had done before. And he did that, and he was like that at Wasps. And him and I became friends, and he coached, and he was hard. He was like, no, you're overthinking this. This is what you need to do. This is what we need to expect. But he did everything with the physicality. And I just think it was a really good time for me, and I wish I'd done more, because I got invited to Hong Kong 3 times, WASP never let me go, got asked to do Wellington 2 times, never got to go, asked to do Singapore, never got to go. The only things I ever did were Dubai and George.
And Samurai in Amsterdam.
And, you know,
hairs on the chest.
And that for me, I think, was one of the best things. I look at young players now who, you know, you get to go and compete at a high level because, you know, I know England haven't taken it, not taking it seriously, but haven't had the investment from the clubs. They've gone a different route. You're telling me that the players going out of these clubs who are used to only one thing, which is rugby, going on the world circuit, having to travel, having to be resilient, having to deal with different hotels, different travel requirements, having to back games up, having to play, train, put their core skills, take them back into premiership training, call them out again. It was invaluable. I think they've gone completely and utterly the wrong way. I think for me, it was the best part of my early years, and I'm thankful for getting to do it, because I got to, you know, we won middle six sevens with WASP, and just, it's hard, it's attritional. I remember when we played against Leicester, fucking talk about Jonah Lomu, Henry Tuilagi. Leicester have wheeled Henry Tuilagi off the loading dock, right? And you're like, in sevens. Honestly, I was like, are you serious? And like, I think Sean was coaching, and we basically, the way we played, we were blitz defensing everything. You know, we just went,
close him out.
Yeah, we went completely out of the book. They were like, counter rocking everything. Blitz and everything, you know, and they went.
That
and
is double Tuilagi. Quits.
And I saw
that, double
honestly,
quits.
Henry Tuilagi got the ball, and I was like, he's done a step. I've literally ran full Joe Worsley round the ankles, but luckily he only had 3 runs in him before they had to take him back off again because he was about 130 kgs. But luckily we never let him get speed because it would have been horrific. Yeah, they would have been chiseling people off the front of him.
Flies so on the windscreen.
What's your thing? Do you think that is a what part of it changed?
I think it's still very pertinent, and I think I get the strains and the stresses to the premiership clubs, but I think if they are truly interested in investing in growing and developing their players for the long term, then they have to be prepared to live without them for 12, 18 months.
Yeah.
And I think in your day, you could come in and out. With the nature of the way the Sevens circuit is now, it's pretty unforgiving,
fine, okay.
More so. But the reality is, what 22-year-old can a premiership club not do without for a year? I mean, Jesus, if you're building your premiership club on a 22-year-old, there's something going on here. And I think when I look at the players that I did get back in those early days, they weren't even in their 23s. By the end of the year, some of them were going on the England A Tour. And they say it was that pathway that helped them. Confidence, ability, learning, different environments.
You're having international quality performance under pressure.
Yeah.
That's what I mean.
Fascinating. I mean, it's a whole other show and pathway and development. And
yeah.
I hope you'll come back and we can do it on time. Did you have dinner with Brady and Giselle?
No. He supports the South Africans, doesn't he?
He does. Well, he caught that right up, didn't he?
He caught that right up.
He did a good luck to the box video.
Good luck to the box video. So, like, Ebner went, like, fuck
that. What are you doing?
Just rolled him out, got him in a USA shirt. All the American boys let him have it. And fair play. I mean, he's like, well,
I don't know what I'm doing.
Why wouldn't I support the box?
Who am I meant to be looking at?
He just dazzled them with the 6 foot 7.
How wrong was he proved?
It's a winning mentality. He spotted it, didn't he?
Time for this week's Guinness Perfect Pour. Our weekly test in 119 and a half seconds, because that's how long it takes to pour the perfect pint of Guinness. This week, in honour of Mike's connection to the States and the Super Bowl semi-finals this weekend, can I just say one thing, which is we've done 60 shows, and producer Simon Wizard drops in a little bit that he is right on the money for this NFL chat.
Yeah,
he just basically wants to be here at the table discussing.
Just before I started sparring today, and I was like,
very excited about the Super Bowl semi-finals this weekend. Our perfect pour is NFL-related. Gies and Hask, we want 7 players currently playing in World Rugby who could fill 7 positions in an NFL team. We will go through them one by one. Have you done a bit of research on this?
Man,
that's it. Devil's in the detail. Which current rugby player in the global game would be a useful quarterback? Smart, leader, great passer, great vision.
Owen Farrell?
You go Farrell, would you?
Yeah.
Quarterback. I'd
go Cipriani.
Would Lovely. You? Sips would be great in those huddles, you know, with the thing and the whooping and the, you know, all that stuff.
Is he good at that?
How do you do that with the sevens? Have you cut that out or
no,
you still encourage
him? No, you can't. I mean, you do what you need. The worst thing is every half-time huddle, right? Remember, they used to always have to apologise for the swearing.
Yeah.
So I've curbed that habit in the halfway or half-time huddle. I don't swear at all now. And as soon as I leave, Danny Barrett literally lets rip with four fucks within 30 seconds. And I'm like, and then I'd like to apologise for Mike Friday. I'm like, Danny?
That's the only broadcasting I ever used to do on the Sevens was coming in to apologise for the language.
How good was Ray Lewis as well with him in those, you know, in those huddles? But if you ever watched the UK, just some of those blokes, America's they're so game. Inspirational, you know.
So you've got Farrell Sips.
Yeah.
You're running back, tough, agile, fast, quick, great runner with the ball in his hands.
I will go with Wadey. I think it'd be
that's
great.
That's too easy, though, isn't it?
I went with Radra.
Oh, you're saying Radra.
Yeah. Wow.
Running back, yeah, wow. Radra.
That is a good shout, right, actually. Yeah.
Fuck, man. Sugar. He is unplayable.
He's unbelievable.
On the Sevens pitch.
Off to Briz.
When I went on tour with my eldest son, we went down to Toulon, and this is when he just...
Where's he playing?
Where my eldest.
Yeah.
And then we were just on Bromley Rugby Club.
Yeah.
We just bossed down there, down at Toulon, met up with Shawsey, he'd rigged up this game. But we went and watched Toulon train.
Yeah.
And Radra just hadn't long landed. And I was like, who the fuck's that? And then we watched the Toulon game that weekend. And, you know, I told to Harrison, I was like, look at Tuisova, he's the kid. Watch this one.
Right, unbelievable.
But he's, you see when he played with Ashton, Ashton scored the record. Semi Radrad is doing everyone, offloading, and then Ashton would just be next to him, and he'd get him, he'd
like
just
a little pilot fish, just floating alongside.
Unreal.
He gave him a couple over the list.
Over the line. But him and Tuisova, what a pair. Do you remember Sean Edwards in the World Cup? Went, well, you know, we're looking at the defence, right? I missed 17 tackles on their wingers, right? And I would bowl at them, but. Have you seen the state of them? We're two of the greatest ball carriers the game's ever seen, so not going too hard. I thought fair play for
that. That's a good shout, Wadey and Randrandra. Wide receiver, great hands, sprinter speed, change of direction ability.
So it's current, right? They've got to be now.
Well, I mean, unless you've got a really good...
I did, but it'd be controversial, so I sacked him off. So I
who were you going to go
I would have gone with Folau, Israel Folau, but he's got to go.
Sack him in the bin.
No, he hasn't. Apparently it's okay. Apparently it's okay. Oh. Apparently they're paying him £8 million. It's okay. We haven't even talked about this. We won't go into it now. I'm signing for WRU and I'm just going to mug everyone off and they'll pay me £8 million.
ARU, let's not bring Welsh
WRU. Jesus. Sorry, ARU.
Your dyslexia's kicking in again.
WRU haven't got £8 million, so it doesn't matter. ARU.
I went Gabriel Ibatoy.
Oh, nice.
He's a small wide receiver, so he's more of a slot receiver.
Yeah.
So he's a lot more like Edelman.
What was the game he played in the other day where he just danced around doing it?
I mean, I'm not sure about his high ball stuff if they went Hail Mary, but I think he'd be a handful.
Gabs Ibatoya,
Big T from Saints.
His name is Tangeli Nairavoro.
Is this size up? I'm about to say it. Nairavoro. Big T, fine.
Big T. Great hand, sprinter speed, change of direction ability. I mean, he's going to plough you a furrow, Big T. NFL will be watching this. Defensive end, big, physical, powerful, great hands to disengage.
I went for, and he's probably a little bit over the hill, but I still think he's probably the best there was, Sergio Parisier.
Nice. We might hopefully be having a chat with him in Six Nations.
Sonny Bill.
Oh, yeah.
What, as a defensive end?
He's big. He's like the Gronk.
He's big and he bangs people and he's just like the Gronk, And he's got great hands.
Yeah.
Don't fucking question me, pal.
Linebacker, fast, great tackler, reads the game well, instinctive. This is an education in the NFL as well. American football.
I went with Jonathan Davis.
Nice, I like 13. That.
Defender, fucking he can read everything. Yeah. I mean, he is...
13, hardest position on the
biggest
defender.
Bigger the game,
better he plays.
The bigger the performance.
I think
that's a great shout.
Undernaws would be quite good. Sam Underhill.
Yeah.
Oh,
Undernaws.
You know, he's Underlords. Yeah, yeah. I think he'd be.
The bell.
Yeah, yeah. That's
a good shout, actually. Yeah, I think I like both of those.
He reads, bangs people. You know, because the way he looked, you never think that he's going to be that diamond. Remember that thing he scored against New Zealand? We did a footwear tournament.
It was on the other day. I saw that stop. Mate, with Bowden Barrett.
Turned him inside out. Looked like a waitress. Tesco's plastic bag. He was. He had the footwork. He's got a bit of speed.
Yeah.
So I thought he was quite good at that.
Good shoulders. Cornerback, covers wide receivers, so fast, ability to change direction quickly.
I went Vakatawa.
Nice. That is a very good shout. I like Vakatawa.
To us over.
Okay.
Yeah.
I love how he gives you your one, right? You can tell you're the guest.
Well, we've discussed Tua Sova already. I mean, they're both...
There
you are.
Put him in with Radjoy. You ain't going wrong, are you?
We are pulling out some serious talent here. I'm a bit worried the NFL are going to come with their checkbook. And kicker, self-explanatory, says Si.
So I went with Halfpenny.
Nice.
Because he stepped in that World Cup semi-final. He kicked everything, didn't he, in that semi-final?
Yeah,
and then he was pretty handy with the Scarlets the other night in that...
Yeah.
Pissing down with rain.
There aren't many who leather it in the way that he does.
Mm. Oh, but the other guy was that. Who's
Neil
that?
Jenkins getting back for the
day. He don't need to be fit, though, does he?
No. He doesn't need to be fit.
Gavin Hastings.
Paul Thilber now.
I love that from 78 or whatever it was. Franz Steen. Distance.
Who was there? I'll go Pollard.
Andre Pollard. Yeah. Do you remember Gavin Hastings playing for the Scottish Claymores?
He had a crack at it, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. I think Bantry did as well.
I thought Wilco should have done it.
Oh, sorry.
Good. I think we'll coach
it. Those fires are out today.
One thing I regret about... because Wilco's one of the greatest rubber players ever, but I always think if I'd had his ability, right, I would have won the World Cup, gone over, done NFL, I would be Hollywood. I would have married an A-lister. I would have been the biggest thing.
You have married an A-lister.
Well, you know, when we did the... of course, I would love it.
Good luck getting you through the front door this evening.
Lucky you're doing that MMA.
You're an A-lister in my heart. But I think, I would have done that. I would have taken over the world.
Have you ever actually just stopped to think about what would have happened if you had kicked the drop goal?
I've thought about it so many times. It's like when people ask you...
Parallel universe.
Oh my God, you daydreaming with rubber players is some downtime, right?
Yeah.
I daydream a lot about winning the lottery, but I've equally daydreamed if I was Johnny Wilkinson, what would have happened?
Where would you be now?
I would have done that advert with Beckham, but I would have been bigger than Beckham because he's so good looking, Johnny, so talented. I would have done NFL, I would be cash money, I'd be Hollywood, there'd be movies, there'd be action figures, there'd be everything, right? Honestly, you wouldn't have seen it. You wouldn't have seen anything like it.
You'd probably be Prime Minister by now.
Oh God, yeah. I'd be taking over the whole setup instead of, you know.
But I guarantee Will Greenwood would have got to you first for that picture.
On your shoulders for the last parade.
I'll tell you what, though. Will Greenwood, he called me the other day. If I was Johnny Wilkinson at that level, he wouldn't have my number. He wouldn't have got through my PAs. When you lot would have been in the dust in the tailpipe. You'd be like, Ash, do you remember that? I'd be like, no, I don't. I don't know who you are. Well, I wouldn't be saying that. My security would.
And get back into reality.
It is weird that I have thought so much about this. The damage. It just would have been on every level.
Back into reality.
It would have been.
It wouldn't have been Johnny, though.
That's what I mean. That's the problem. But if you could take his power and put it into my body, it would have been unstoppable.
You're off on Friday to Hamilton.
Hamilton, yeah.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, long
little,
old.
Little busy premium, or are you back on the bus again?
Definitely turning right.
Olympics 2020. How are you going to get on?
Well, we're hoping to medal. That's the plan.
Is there pressure?
Only the pressure we put on ourselves. I mean, don't get me wrong.
Straight out of the media handbook.
I think the reality is on that for us is I think we'll find out about rugby in America if we do medal.
Okay, that's fair. I was going to say, what if you do, what happens?
That's the $6 million. Everyone thinks they know what will happen. Somebody needs to convince me.
Yeah.
I think the high schools are the key.
Really?
Not a gold medal.
Genuinely, I would...
If you need an assistant for that, don't forget your old mate. I'm coming.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. That's the media training.
Yeah, I mean, if you want media people dressed badly with
hopefully we'll need security on the way back.
100%. You're all looking about that. For those fighting. I'm a fighter. I'm a fighter.
That is it for this week. Thank you, as always, for watching and listening to the House of Rugby. We're a YouTube show and a podcast. Don't forget Liquid Football with Kelly Cates, and the team is out every Monday. Thank you to Hask. Really enjoyed having you in.
Thank you. Very nice
to catch up. We could do another 3 or 4 of these. So next time you're in town for 15 minutes.
Do you reckon if he wins the Olympic medal, it'll be too big time to come on?
No, I'll never
ben
be
Ryan,
big.
Ben no, Ryan, no, I'll never be big. Big.
Yeah. Fine. Small time. Big. Will it be small time?
Come and, yeah, do. I mean, there'll be a lot of people who hope that you do medal because of the interest that will come off the back of it.
Yeah, me
so
too.
So go get it. Yeah, exactly. Go get it.
He's got an extension on his gaff that he's got to do with the medal coming. What are you hoping for the medal? Oh, a double garage and a spare room, actually.
Very nice too. Next week should actually be a very interesting episode as well. We're going to talk pain, injury, depression and what to do with your life when your career comes to an end at 28.
If anyone
with another
knows,
former
let me know.
Wasps man in the shape of back row forward Alex Reader, who's a...
good friend of mine. Good friend of
yours.
What a boy.
Yeah, exactly. So we look forward to having him. And he retired just before Christmas with a catastrophic knee injury. So that will be very interesting indeed. Look forward to that one. Geezer, thank you as always. See you again soon. See you again soon as well. Have a good week. And we're back next Wednesday.
You've been listening to the House of Rugby on Joe. Together with Guinness. Drink responsibly. Visit drinkaware.co.uk for the facts.